So I'm really confused about how the writing staff of DS9 managed to write a script about the election of Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's pretty prescient of them.
This was a very weird episode to watch at this particular point in time, since this is about someone charismatically horrible, although would you describe Trump as charismatic, who has misled a group of people into following him into something that's really bad for them. And this is a, you know, this series in general, the way we've talked about in the Odo and Wei Yun episode the other week.
Treachery, Faith in the Great River.
Yeah, in Treachery, Faith in the Great River, obviously, faith is what changes simply a changeling into a god. Faith is what turns wormhole aliens into prophets. Faith is usually a very, in this show and in general, faith is usually a very good term, a very positive term. And here we have...
I don't know that I would agree, though, that the faith of the Dvord and the Jem'Hadar
is
good.
That's fair. I guess when it comes to the prophets, faith is a good thing. When it comes to the Bajoran religion, faith is a good thing. Here we see faith very much twisted, and everyone on the show, Dukat being the kind of wild card in a way that I guess we'll talk about, everyone in this episode has very strong faith in this cult of the Paw Wraiths, and we see it slowly crumbling and breaking down in the face of challenges to it. For some people, their faith is stronger than others. For the Vedic that is Kira's friend, for example, his faith is so unshakable that he, you know, commits suicide in the face of evidence against it rather than being able to live with it, you know?
Yeah, well, I definitely want to talk about the character of Vedic Fala, because I think he's really key to the episode and key to Kira's journey in this episode. But I want to disagree with you a little bit about this particular faith being bad, though, because I'm kind of playing devil's advocate here a little bit.
Pirate's advocate?
Yeah. Is that I don't know that. I mean, the only reason why we think the Paw Wraiths are evil or bad is because the show has told us that.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there's much evidence for that. I mean, certainly, we are getting everything from the point of view of the Bajorans. We're getting everything from the point of view of Sisko the Emissary and from the point of view of the Prophets to some degree. We're not really getting anything from the point of view of the Paw Wraiths. And I think this episode, Covenant, is doing that work in showing us a version of, and they never say that, Akira refers to it as the cult of the Paw Wraith. I don't think anybody that's actually involved refers to it as that. So I think that's key as well.
I think the other the Vedic ones, you know, calls it a cult using it very sarcastic terms, like, oh, this cult that I'm in, or something like along those lines.
Right. And he specifically refers to the Paw Wraiths as the true prophets.
Yeah. Now his interpretation with this true prophets, that's very similar to Gnosticism, which, states that the God that we know of the Judeo-Christian Bible is what they call the Demiurge. It's a false God. There is a that is created by the larger true God in a lot of ways. And so that's kind of the interpretation of where the Paw Wraiths are. They're the true gods. They're the ones who, because the conflict between the prophets and the Paw Wraiths, as we've understood it to this point, is that the prophets are the true gods and the Paw Wraiths are trying to usurp that. This Vedic and Dukat both seem to think that the Paw Wraiths, again, one of the things that I'd said is that the Paw Wraiths and the prophets are the same class of beings, and this episode seems to go along those lines as well, but the Paw Wraiths want to take more of an active role in helping Bajor. The people who believe in the Paw Wraiths are doing so because that they believe the role of their gods is to actively have a hand in things. Why did the prophets let the Cardassians walk all over them? Why are the prophets letting the Dominion cross through the wormhole? Wouldn't a real god stop them? And the Paw Wraiths are the ones who are willing to do that. And so, yes, they are more gods of action.
Well, I think, yeah, but there's a couple things there. I think I want to step away from the faith stuff for a minute and just look at the wormhole aliens. And I'm calling them that very specifically for a very specific reason.
Yes.
Because if we look at them divorced from the Bajoran religion, right, and we just say, here's a group, this is a species, this is a non-corporeal species that lives in a wormhole that assumedly would have its own culture, its own society, its own rules and laws and beliefs and all of these kind of things. If we just look at it from a purely non-religious viewpoint whatsoever, it seems to me that from everything that we've all the evidence that we've gotten, you know, in the last couple seasons of the show, is that the let's call them the prophets, for want of a better term, and the Paw Wraiths, even though those seem to be names that perhaps the Bajorans have put on them and they don't really use themselves necessarily.
That's true. We haven't really seen prophets and Paw Wraiths as a group interacting very much. A little bit in The Reckoning.
The Reckoning, yeah. And that was just one Paw Wraith and one prophet
doing their apocalyptic battle. Yeah, how are they in a normal... Anyway.
And what it seems to me is that there was some sort of civil war that happened, mm-hmm. and the prophets won and cast the Paw Wraiths out, which essentially... They, you know, it's like anything else. They drove them out of the city. They drove them out of the country. Yeah. They drove them out of the wormhole. They drove them out of where they live, their land, essentially.
Apparently imprisoned them in certain statues or relics from what we've seen.
Right. And so, I mean, it's a little different, of course, because it's science fiction. Yeah. And we're dealing with non-corporeal beings. But so if you look at it purely from that point of view, I don't really know that we have enough information to know. Like, I don't think that, and that's, I think we kind of talked about this a little bit in the last Prophet episode as well, but I don't know that there's a lot of evidence. I don't know that we can make a clear argument whether or not the prophets are actually good and whether or not the prophets are actually looking out for Bajor. What I think is so, you know, so striking about this entire storyline in the show is that it's got two components, really, which is that the prophets are doing things that are sort of immutable and unknowable to the Bajorans and even to Sisko, although Sisko does talk to them a lot more than anybody else, perhaps anybody else. But the other part of that, of course, is the Bajoran faith and what that means for them. And this episode, I think, is really grappling with that, because I can definitely understand, and this is where the character of Vedic Fala comes in, I think, because you can really understand a Vedic, a person of faith who lived through the occupation of Bajor, who saw horrible, horrible things that the Cardassians did to the Bajoran people, you know, murder, rape, you know, all sorts of horrible things, working people to death, et cetera, et cetera. And losing his faith in the prophets because sort of understanding that the prophets did not want to step in and stop this. And that's a classic crisis of faith.
Yeah, that the general why do bad things happen to good people, done to a much more extreme degree then, but yeah, the general feeling that the role of a god is to help the faithful. What is the, in a way...
And not even to help the faithful, but to help the Bajoran people.
Well, yeah.
Because one of the things that's always been so striking about Bajor in general is that it's pretty much a theocracy in some respects. Like, everybody's a believer. And if you're not a believer, you just don't have any religion. Like, there doesn't seem to be different sects of the Bajoran religion, except now, which seems to be developing.
The Paw Wraith, because this Vedic, and I keep forgetting his name.
Fala.
Vedic Fala, says that he's been a follower of the Paw Wraiths for years, since well into the occupation. And from the... From bits and pieces of dialogue here and there, you get the sense there have always been the Paw Wraith cult, but they've always kind of been a very small, very weird fringe. You know, they're the wackos. They're the weird. You know, their religion is just they're just the people ranting on the street. Now, especially with Dukat leading them, they seem to be much more organized, and their faith is getting stronger. They have, frankly, a bit more concrete evidence of their faith.
Yeah, yeah. And well, it's interesting, too, because, of course, the Bajorans didn't have any real concrete evidence of their faith other than the orbs of the prophets either. So, you know, 7 years ago when the show first started and the Celestial Temple / Wormhole was discovered by the Federation, that was the first concrete example that the prophets had returned to Bajor.
Although, to be fair, the existence of the orbs is pretty concrete evidence of something.
Whether
or not the prophets are still there or not, they don't know. But that is a very inarguable touched by a god kind of. I know we have had some troubles using the word god to describe the prophets, but Vedic Fala does say gods to refer to them in this episode. So I think that means fair game.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, certainly sometimes episodes just say things that they never follow up on again. And they've never been referred to gods before. And I don't really want to get into a conversation about that right now.
But I guess whenever I've used, you know, the term prophets as God, I use it to mean generic divine being of some kind of theological importance. But is it necessarily the God? doesn't really matter.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, I don't think we've really come to any conclusions about the Paul race. Again, I don't know that they're quote-unquote evil. I think that we view them as evil because the show keeps telling us they are, and certainly Gul Dukat believing them and being this emissary of the Paw Wraiths is not a good development. But...
Well, let's look at where we've seen the Paw Wraiths before. First was the episode where Keiko was possessed by them. Now, we of course view the Paw Wraiths as evil from that because Keiko herself says, I felt hatred, I felt, you know, their anger, he was going to kill us. This is somebody who is extraordinarily desperate, if...
But again, to play devil's advocate here, this was a person that was cast out of their home and imprisoned.
It's a very desperate attempt. It's a very... It's the kind of thing, though, that Kira has done herself. It's the kind of thing that we have seen characters do that because, again, their cause was important enough.
Yeah.
In the next, we see them in Reckoning where they are against the Prophets. Now, the Prophets are the people that we as Viewpoint characters have been aligned with for more. So, of course, we're going to put them into the bad guy role, especially because, you know, it's scary and it has all these red lightning and all of that. And now that Gul Dukat is the one who they've chosen as their emissary, as the kind of anti-emissary in a way, of course, again, it is very possible that the Paw Wraiths are the true gods who actively want to help Bajor, and it's just that we've seen them in some very situations without proper context look really bad for them. The evidence is circumstantial right now.
Well, yeah, and I don't know, honestly, I don't know how much it really matters which of the two groups the true gods of Bajor, right? I don't think that really matters that much. And certainly it matters to the Bajoran people, but for us as viewers, I don't think it matters.
I guess their intentions do matter to a degree. What do their goals? What if in a perfect world, what would the wormhole aliens want? What would the Paw Wraiths want? We can make those kind of calculuses, but...
Well, there's two things. I think number one, on the concept of, or the idea that we're not getting all of the context, and the context that we do get puts the Prophets in the good category, quote unquote. I mean, let's not forget that they also did send a wormhole alien to Earth to take over a human, to have a relationship with Sisko's father, to make sure that Sisko the emissary was born and then left her. That's not a great thing to do.
That's they do have some methods that cross lines.
Sure. And the Paw Wraiths have done that kind of stuff too, but you know, they both do it. And you know, the other thing about it is that I don't know to what degree it gets a little tricky, because I don't think that the show really has a good understanding of... I don't think that they really sat down and developed the storyline. I think this is developing more organically. One of the reasons they wanted to do this particular episode was just because they felt like Dukat was kind of getting pushed aside.
Yeah.
And if you remember, I think his last appearance was Wrongs Darker Than Death or Night, and he was in it very briefly. And before that was Waltz. And before that, he was a pretty integral part of the six-parter that kicked off the sixth season of the show.
And this, you know, in some ways takes him back a little from the cartoonish version that he was almost starting to be.
A little bit, yeah.
He is, you know, now he is the cult leader, and he is a little over the top still, but this is, again, I, you know, started saying, you know, this is about Donald Trump, but in a way he is a portrayal of certain very realistic in the way cults and political groups really do operate.
Yeah, but I think it's important to note that the show very carefully doesn't question Dukat's faith in the Paw Wraiths. I think Dukat actually does believe in them.
Well, was touched. He was very literally possessed by a Paw Wraith for a while. It's again, you talk about the question of evidence for your faith is a contentious one in a lot of ways, but... That said, Dukat has very strong evidence that the Paw Wraiths exists and have very specific designs.
Now, of course, I mean, the other thing, I didn't notice this while I was watching the episode, but one of the points in the kind of production notes on Memory Alpha for this episode was that they very clearly showed Dukat praying alone at one point. You don't do that if you don't believe. You know, certainly yeah. he would be leading prayers, he would be blessing people in public, but if he was just doing this as a vehicle for gaining some sort of power or hold or getting back his position to some degree, he would not be praying in private. And so I think that that does complicate his character a bit.
Yeah. He is extraordinarily hypocritical, but he is also a very Gul Dukat, even a redeemed Gul Dukat, is still good. I mean, Akira at one point says, like, oh, you know, he's the biggest one for sins of the flesh or something like that, right? So, yeah, Gul Dukat is a kind of person with, no matter how religious his feelings are, no matter how much towards chastity he's preaching, he is going to see a pretty Bajoran woman and not be able to help himself and be horrible about it. So,
and I mean, let's not forget the other thing, too, which is that I think a Gul Dukat who is religious, who views what he does is right because his yeah. gods tell him it's right, who has believers behind him, who is called the master. He calls himself the emissary at one point of the Pah Rites. Yeah. This is not the type of personality. This is not the type of man that should have that sort of backing behind him, because he can justify whatever he does, having sex with the Bajoran woman. Her name is Mika. I don't want to other her, so I want to make sure I mention yeah. her name. Then he tries to murder her. You know, these kind of things. He at the end of the episode, when he wants them all to commit suicide, these are all actions.
And Heaven's Gate had been really recent.
This was actually based on Heaven's Gate.
I think it was only like 2 or 3 years previous at this point.
Yeah, right? Heaven's Gate was 97 and this was 99.
Oh my God. But 90, anyway.
End of 98, early 99, yeah. It's funny, I remember Heaven's Gate because I was doing a week of internship at the local newspaper where I grew up, and that story broke when I was there. And that's I have a clear memory of
it. That was a hell of a thing.
Weird. But yeah, that was definitely based on that. And interestingly enough, I didn't know this either, but Nichelle Nichols' brother was part of the Heaven's Gate
cult
and committed suicide. Yeah.
Wow.
So a little Star Trek connection there, sadly.
Wow.
But I think that, I mean...
In a way,
here's my question for you. I have two questions for you. Number one is, the episode starts out by telling us what the three keys of enlightenment of the Bajoran religion are, and they are charity, humility, and faith. Mm. Is that part of the Pah Rites cult? Number one, and number two is one of the stated, and these are completely separate questions, so I'm sorry, but the other question I have is, one of the stated goals of this episode was they felt like they had forgotten Gul Dukat, wanted to bring him back into the mix. They also wanted to make him the villain of Deep Space Nine again.
Yeah.
And I actually don't think this episode does that.
No, especially because at the end
I think it would be very, very easy to take this episode at face value and get a story about Gul Dukat cynically starting a cult. I don't see that story here.
No, and it's true, because, again, his faith is complicated. Gul Dukat has always believed his own bullshit, but he really believes his own bullshit, and now his bullshit is religious in nature. I mean, that I guess, is the... Because all the time, don't we point to the Christian right and say, you know, well, they're adulterating themselves, they're doing, you know, they're screwing over the poor, they're doing everything bad that they're saying to do, but... In a way, they're using that to bolster their own faith. I guess what is the most shocking bit of the episode is when she has the baby. It's obviously Gul Dukat's kid, like, duh. And everybody knows that. And he manages to turn ironclad evidence of his infidelity and everything he does wrong into a fucking sign from the gods. And... the way his power is at that point so entrenched that everybody kind of has to go along and believe it, even if they don't quite. I mean, as Kira's saying to Farrah, he's, you know, you're an intelligent person. Like, why are you not seeing this? And again, in their cases, the faith is trumping the actual evidence in front of their eyes.
Let's put a moratorium on using that verb for the next 4 years, by the way.
Which?
Trump.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. you know, that's the problem. Like, I think Pence will be a very good thing to verb into something, you know, horrible. But Trump is already a word, so. I guess he uses – Dukat seems to view his failings, I don't want to say human failings, but, you know, in real life, that's how we would phrase it, his Cardassian failings, his failings being in the flesh, as a way of showing, in a way, bolstering his own image. Oh, I'm not a perfect person, and therefore I'm very human, and therefore I'm the most human, and therefore I'm very favored by God. And in a way, he's using his favor by God to make the other stuff okay. You know, I do so much good for the world that even though I've fallen because I'm an imperfect creation, I can still be forgiven for that.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I think that Gul Dukat's motivations here are very complicated. And I also think that, you know, his decision at the end of the episode to have everyone commit suicide, which of course does not happen because Kira breaks up the party, is that I don't think that he really wants those people to die, but I think that he realizes that he's reached the end of his rope here.
Yeah.
I mean, Gul Dukat has not been transformed by this faith. And I think that the only real clear evidence we get that the faith in the Pa Wraiths is perhaps not a good thing is the fact that Dukat is at the head of it. I mean, honestly, I mean, that's a little bit of a tautology because Dukat is a bad guy. So therefore, whatever he believes is bad. So therefore, his actions out of that faith are bad. But
let's imagine a version of the episode which ends with Gul Dukat disgraced and Vedic Fala becoming the new head of the Pa Wraith worshippers or cult or whatever you want to call them. A vision of the...
I mean, I want to stay away from the word cult because...
Yeah, and I'm trying to avoid that, yeah.
Cult is a loaded term that is used as a bludgeon against belief systems that are not your own, so...
Yeah, so, again, that's, you know, the Pa Wraith worshippers or whatever. They're followers.
Let's call them a sect. Let's call them a branch of the Bajoran religion, whatever you know.
If Vedic Fala is leading that, you can see a version that will be. I mean, everything that they say about we're a community, we, you know, help each other out, we're living together, you know, what we see of it, that what we see of the parts of it that are not Gul Dukat seem to be pretty nice. They're, you know, just people who are living in a religious community together. It's humble and simple, but they're doing what they're doing, you know. That under the leadership of somebody who is capable and sincere and not as wackadoo as Gul Dukat can get, would that be a negative thing? Would that be a bad thing to put into the world?
Well, again, I don't know, because I think that the episode tries to convince us that the Pa Wraith worship is bad because Gul Dukat's at the head of it.
Yes.
And that's a little bit of a lazy shortcut. And I think it's more complicated than that. And I do think you're right that if Fala had not committed suicide at the end of the episode and had decided to take over the Pa Wraith community, it may have ended in a very different place, and perhaps Kira would have had more to think about.
Yeah, and but maybe that would be a branch between the reconciliation of them within to the large. Like, maybe that would be.
Well, that's my one problem with the end of the episode is that it does make this all about a cult of personality with Dukat. And as soon as Dukat leaves and Fala commits suicide, the implication is that everyone's just going to, you know, drift away
off and go home
and go back to Bajor, wherever they live. And
maybe even be a little worse off because, frankly, the kinds of people who are going to join a cult like this aren't the most – don't have the biggest social support systems. Their cult will become that support system. And again, putting this to a positive use, having this be a true religious community would be one thing, would be a positive for all of these people. But just leaving them alone, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we haven't talked about Kira a lot in this episode, and she's really only there to document what goes on.
Yeah.
She doesn't really have a lot to do in the episode.
Yeah, even as late as the part... I mean, when Gul Dukat comes to her before the pill ceremony and he's saying, oh, I've contacted DS9 there. Because the entire episode focuses on her storyline. We have that little bit where they're like, well, where did Kira go? She had a transponder. That's the only time we see of the gang, really, besides the beginning. And
I want to talk specifically about the very beginning of the episode because I think it ties in very nicely with the message of this episode. But
certainly. But, I mean, Gul Dukat, once he says, like, oh, I've contacted DS9, like, his intention never was to hurt her. She is getting out of this. It really doesn't, you know, her goal does become about, you know, fighting for this colony community, this group's survival because... But it's not for herself anymore. She is in no real danger. She's just there to either approve or, at the end, leave with some things to think about.
Yeah, I think so. Well, what do you make of, I think, the very beginning of the episode, which is, I think it ties in very nicely with the theme of the episode, because If you remember, it starts out with Odo talking in Quark's about how much he wishes he shared the Bajoran faith because he could go and share more time with Kira. And that shared faith is on the same. It's kind of I think it's a little teenage of Odo in a way, because he's like, we have to spend all this time together, because, you know, he's basically a teenager about this stuff.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, and, you know, Ezri thinks it's cute and Bashir's being quiet because I'm sure Bashir doesn't give a shit.
Yeah.
But I think that what I want to say about that is, what we do see a group of people that share a faith, and it doesn't necessarily end well. And so, you know, that the beginning of that episode is framing a shared faith as a good thing that keeps people together. And by the end of the episode, the Pa Wraith community has been completely destroyed.
Yeah. Well, I guess it does deal with the complications of a relationship where one partner is extremely religious and the other is not. I mean, he is. I think it's even, yes, there is some of, oh, I'd like to spend all the time with Kira, but I mean, they're not living together at this point yet either. So I think part of it is just, this is very important to Kira. I wish that I were into that too, because then we would be able to share in this, you know, we would have another thing in common. It would be more of a bond between the other. It's interesting how they take that. So, you know, Odo saying, oh, I don't have faith. And Kira saying, yeah, it would be nice if you did, but, you know, I understand. And then they bring up the possibility of, oh, well, what if Odo had faith in Klingon faith, for example, or any of the other thousands of, you know, religions that in a place like DS9 you would have access to. And, you know, it's interesting that Kira basically says, oh, I wouldn't have. No, that would be fine, you know, if it were something he believed, you know, that's fine too. Like, let's face it, Odo is never going to be a member of the Pa Wraith cult. He's not going to be a member of an evil or contentious religion just because of the person that he is. And I think that is part of where Kira's blanket approval of Odo having any faith would be fine. The faith that he would have would be positive faith. But then it is leading to his original point. Odo doesn't necessarily desire faith for its own sake, but because it would be something more, it would be another avenue of connection with Kira.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Religion for him wouldn't be a way to connect with the spiritual. It would be a way of connecting with the person he loves.
And is that a bad thing?
No, it isn't.
Because I mean, I'm not a believer, so I maybe have a different opinion about this. But I don't really think that faith in and of itself is good or bad. You know, it's really what you do with it. And and if someone believes in something, you know, I don't care. You know, it's not like I'm going to tell them to stop because it's stupid or whatever. I mean, I think that's really kind of a gross attitude, actually. But
you're not Richard Dawkins.
Right. I'm not Richard Dawkins. But surprise, surprise. But I think that, you know, what it really comes down to, and I don't think this is a profound statement or anything, but it's really, you know, what you do with that faith. That's the important thing. And whether or not you're honoring it.
Yeah.
You know, certainly I can call it hypocrisy, and everybody in the episode can call it hypocrisy. And I think that's what Kira is doing in this episode.
Yeah.
She's calling out what she sees as Dukat's hypocrisy.
I mean, but all, you know, to be fair, from her perspective, this is somebody who has been raised Christian, who is coming up against a bunch of Satanists, you know. Now, real life Satanism is more about individuality and freedom of choice, you know, without harming other people. But
yeah, we're not talking about a Rosemary's Baby situation.
Yeah, exactly. Levian Satanism, and this is the equivalent of somebody, you know, seeing through the trappings, realizing that there are some positive bits to it, but ultimately deciding that it is a little too beyond the pale for that.
Yeah. I mean, I also think maybe the final thing to say before we move on to It's Only a Paper Moon is that the Pa Wraith temple scenes are kind of nice. And I don't really think that there's anything that wrong with them. They're very similar to Bajoran temple services. And I think that that's, you know, again, I kind of feel like the stated goal of the episode is really at odds with what the episode shows in a weird way.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Again, if we had see, I think a lot of the problem with the temple scenes is because we have Gul Dukat doing this. And I think there is a bit of, from Kira's viewpoint, some legitimate, why is a Cardassian leading a Bajoran service? But the emissary of the prophets is a human. He's not a Bajoran himself. It's, again, for Dukat to be the emissary of the Pa Wraiths and the prophets as being opposite factions. Again, there's a very nice symmetry here that I do like. So yes, on the symmetries it's setting up, he is being set up as the big bad of DS9 again.
Yeah.
If the episode doesn't quite get to that point, I think it's because it kind of has to, because at the end of the day, we are dealing with, you know, quote unquote, real Bajorans who are actually faithful and who aren't necessarily evil and who have been attracted to the good parts of Dukat's message. And frankly, this does muddy the waters of Dukat, because as much as he believes in, you know, the horrible things that he believes, do those negate the good things that he believes as well?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think that's a good opportunity for us to move on to It's Only a Paper Moon.
Okay.
So I wasn't sure if you were going to hate this episode or like it.
You know, I'm not the biggest Vic Fontaine fan, but he is growing on me a bit. And what they do with Nog, I really liked in this episode. So yes, I was fond of this.
Oh, good.
This
okay.
was one of those kind of small character pieces that the series does so well. And again, it's not, Nog has gone into, you kept saying from the beginning of the show, you know, watch out for Nog. He is going to change. He's going to be a very different character than he starts off as. And, you know, I do like seeing that I mean, this is probably Nog's best episode just in terms of what the actor gets to work with, right?
Well, there is an episode later on in the season when he becomes the head of Starfleet Intelligence.
Oh.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think this is Nog's best episode. He gets a lot. Aaron Eisenberg gets a lot of really good material to work with. And
he gets a,
when I remember watching this show the first time I saw it, I was blown away by this episode because I really didn't think, I mean, he's a fine actor.
Yeah,
but the
monologue that he has, for example, that was a good monologue.
I mean, really, this episode comes down to the chemistry between the Nog character and the Vic Fontaine character. You know, I think his name is, what is his name? I don't remember the name of the guy who plays Vic Fontaine. I feel bad.
Well.
But between the two actors and also their acting chops. And you could really see a version of this episode that went very wrong, because neither of them were really asked before to do something like this with this emotional depth to honestly carry this much screen time. I mean, if you think about one of the things that always amazes me about Deep Space Nine, and one of the things that always I think is a really missed opportunity in Voyager, which we'll talk about in a little while, we're getting very close to Voyager.
Oh my God.
Is that Voyager doesn't really do very much with developing any secondary characters. Mm. It doesn't really do much with developing its primary characters, honestly. But Deep Space Nine just does so much with their secondary characters. And here we have an episode of the show which essentially, aside from a few brief scenes, doesn't really feature any of the main cast members, aside from Jake Sisko, who was a cast member in credits only. Most of the other, you know, Nog and Vic Fontaine have the most screen time. Then you've got Jake and you've got Rom and Lita.
Yeah.
This all makes sense, of course, because those are the people that are closest to Nog. But
Quark as well, but he's even less in this episode. He isn't as active in this episode as Rom is, for example.
And it works. It works really well. And I think that I love this episode so much because a TNG version of this storyline of Nog losing his leg, that would have been the end of it. You know, he would have come back in a few episodes. Yeah. He would have been fine. A new leg would have been attached to him and everything would move on. But this episode really does show because the thing about Deep Space Nine, I think, especially that you're seeing in the seventh season, is that they do things with big space battles. And, you know, the end of the war will happen at some point. That they're not going to leave that plot line unresolved. But, and we'll see how that ends, but they're doing a lot of the war stuff in a very sort of symbolic, a very emotional way. This is really a story about someone who, you know, had never really been in battle before, who got this traumatic injury, who's dealing with PTSD, who's dealing with realizing that he is not invincible.
Yeah. What this is reminding me is that TNG had Picard go through this kind of a thing. That was the point of Family, right? That was the point of, they have, it's explicitly referenced in other episodes that Troy spent some time canceling him, and that he still, even past recovery, still occasionally has times where he is.
But you would expect that because Picard is the nominal main character of the show.
Well, yeah, and he's not only the nominal main character of the show. What happens is that he is captured by one of the greatest enemies of the Federation and literally had horrible surgeries performed on him, changed into a different species even, you know, been forced to think in an entirely different way, been forced to a, you know, what happens to him is so, what happens to Nog is just he gets his leg shot off. And he still has this amount of trauma for that. Like the recognition of that. I mean, this is much more of a, you know, between this and Sons of Moog, for example, think episodes like that, which show that even small brushes with the war have major traumas on the people who are affected by it.
Yeah.
And that's something that, frankly, in our society, we need to remember.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the notes in Memory Alpha for this episode was that, you know, Aaron Eisenberg, I don't think, did a lot of research on PTSD or anything like that for this episode, but he did say that he was contacted by a lot of combat veterans who said that this was very true to life.
Yeah.
Very true to their experiences. And, you know, probably for the first 15 or 20 minutes of the episode, I mean, Nog is being cruel. Nog is obviously not doing well. My question, of course, was don't they have headphones in the future? Because, you know, he was listening to that song over and over again, which was bothering Jake, which, yeah, that would bother me too. But, like, get some headphones, dude. Maybe they can't fit the Ferengi ears.
I was going to say, they need to be this big.
But he's not doing well, and when he hits upon this idea of staying in the holosuite, and everyone is sort of concerned about this, you know, I can see that being a concern because he is retreating into a fantasy world where he's really forgetting about his life, but it seems like that's what he needs right now.
Yeah, and that's kind of, you know, you have O'Brien talking about it to the woman in that episode who turns out to be dead all the whole time and it's from the future or whatever.
The sound of her voice.
Yes. You have them acknowledging that they don't have a counselor on the ship. And so what we've got is Ezri, and we've also got Vic Fontaine, who's kind of the Guinan of this show, right? Like that's
actually, yeah.
Yeah. Him more so than Quark is a Guinan kind of figure. Cause Quark is not always the kind of person that you want counseling you through your PTSD. I mean, I don't
think you want Quark helping you through much.
But yeah, I mean, we've seen, you know, I joked on the first Vic Fontaine episode, like, oh, he's so meddling. Like, you know, if he were, because he's a rogue AI at this point. Like, let's not put any pretense to it. He's not evil. He means the best, and I think Vic Fontaine is going to do the best for everybody, but he is going so beyond what he should be doing.
Well, I think that I may have talked about this when Vic Fontaine first appeared and they made this mention that he knows he's a hologram. And I have to remind you that it's a little weird watching the shows in this order because Voyager was doing a lot with a holographic character that a lot of the groundwork had already been done, and so they kind of were assuming that you had been watching Voyager for the past four years. And you knew about the Doctor and you knew about all that stuff. And so this Vic Fontaine character is DS9 sort of latching on to that idea.
Yeah, see, I'm just coming at this from Moriarty, TNG, who was the, you know, it was, he knew he, I mean, because Moriarty and Vic Fontaine are essentially, you know, two sides. We talk about mirror versions of you know, Sisko and Dukat. Well, Moriarty and Vic Fontaine are two sides of the same coin, except Vic Fontaine is the one who was using his powers as a hologram for good, and he gets rewarded with an eternal existence. Moriarty uses his holographic powers for bad, and he gets essentially prisoned in a hologram at the end.
Yeah, well, Moriarty was also developed based on an evil villain from you know,
exactly
pulp novel from the 19th century. So that kind of makes sense.
I mean, I certainly think Vic Fontaine is the much more interesting character, but I guess a lot of the implications I'm taking from this, again, they're all along the lines of after the second time that Data gets hacked, why do they still let him on the bridge? But
yeah, it's just kind of at a certain point, you just have to go with it, I guess, because it's a TV show. But I don't know. I mean, I've always liked Vic Fontaine. I know that he's not a lot of people's favorite character. I don't really understand why, but I guess in the same way that I don't really understand why people like Morn so much. So it's just a gap in my knowledge that I don't really get. But I like Vic Fontaine. I have a soft spot for that sort of, you know,
again, he's starting 60s to grow on
Las
me.
Vegas stuff. And he's definitely the kind of character that's, I think, fun. He's fun in small doses, but in this episode, he really rises to the occasion because, you know, the guy who plays Vic Fontaine does a really good job at, in this episode, making him develop into a real person.
Yeah.
And obviously he's there to help Nog, and he is very willing to do so because he's a hologram. And I guess why not? Because he gets to be on all the time. But he doesn't really think through the implications of what that means to be on all the time.
Yeah, when he's talking to Ezri later on, and she's saying, oh, well, you know, and, oh, it's at some point he's going to leave, right? And then you realize that Vic Fontaine has himself gotten so caught up on this, he's forgotten that at some, you know, at some point he does have to leave. Because I think he and, I mean, it is very poignant. There is a that this isn't reality, you know, Vic Fontaine and Nog working together to open a bar after his time in the service. If that's how Nog was, if this were real, if these were real people and Nog was doing this, that would be extraordinarily productive and a very good kind of healthy way of him to figure out, make a life for himself after the war. But,
well, I have two thoughts about that. I think number one is that it's not really that Vic Fontaine is forgetting that this isn't reality. It's that this is his reality.
And not, I guess not forgetting is per se, it's just, you know, he knows that it's just, this is more exciting in a way. Like, it's slipping his mind more than forgetting. I mean,
well,
this is...
I disagree with you. This is Vic Fontaine's reality. And I think that him being on all the time and having to develop a life and a personality a little bit more and really having Nog around to help him do things. And this is his reality. Hmm. This is his reality. And so I think he forgets that because not because he's being malicious, not because he doesn't think that Nog should go back to reality, but that this is really his world. This is his life.
Fontaine seems to be more aware of, he seems to be aware of the difference between the reality, and he knows that the real reality is, quote unquote, more important. He knows that Nog is going to be, but yeah,
I mean, he does and he doesn't. I think that the episode has to have Vic Fontaine at the end of the episode completely turn off his program. And,
yeah.
You know, he has control over his program. You know, again, that's a thing from Voyager, so it's not, I don't want to talk about it that much because it's a little weird that he can do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was established in Voyager, so let's just go with it. We can talk more about Vic Fontaine and compare them with the Doctor when we get to Voyager. But
Doctor Who?
No, the Doctor.
Yeah, Doctor Who.
Oh, God. And also listen to our patron special back in December about Doctor Who. That patreon.com/trekaboutshow, $5 a month or more. That Vic Fontaine, I think the other part of that is Vic Fontaine has feelings. They can be hurt.
Yeah.
I think that I don't know that I necessarily, I mean, certainly it's not, I don't think it's a completely healthy thing if Nog lived out the rest of his years in that holosuite. You know, he and Vic Fontaine are in business together, and he's completely living in this fantasy of, you know, 1962 America. And I guess he would see all sorts of changes, and it would be the 90s, and he'd be into grunge and go to Seattle. I don't know. But it is, I don't know, I struggle with it because the show is really arguing, I think, at this point, especially at the end when Nog says that he has, you know, gotten an agreement with Quark to leave the holoscope running all day, every day, 7 days a week, or however many days of the week there are in the Bajoran week, that Vic Fontaine is getting the opportunity to live a full and rich life, that he has a right to that life.
Yes.
And so for me, I think it's a little bit of a blind spot on the character's part, Ezri in particular. And I think, rightly, I don't think this is a blind spot on the writer's part. I think it's a blind spot in the character's part. That, yes, Nog is living in a fantasy world. He has to leave eventually. He's here for therapy. He's here to get better. But he is doing productive work. He is doing things that matter because they matter to Vic Fontaine.
Well, and my question was, which they kind of do address at the end with leaving the Sawn, what if let's posit there's a bar that Nog opens in the real world, which does have holographic projectors so that Vic Fontaine can perform and schmooze and everything, and real actual people can go into there, which, I mean, that's part of the implication of what, I mean, Quark himself, when he visits Fontaine's, seems to like the place. It's not impossible that he might open Fontaine's up, you know, charge a cover to go in there. But,
sure, yeah.
You know, then it's this, oh, it's a nightclub, you know, decorated like 1960s Earth, and here's a singer that performs every night. Like, it, you know, that's certainly a club that Nog could, you know, work on.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, certainly it's not like they're going to have to balance the books and worry about, you know, alcohol and stuff, because, you know, it's all replicated. But at the same time, if they had real people coming in, certainly they would have to get real alcohol in there, real food. I mean, you know, all these things. So it would become a real thing.
I mean, I wasn't sure if the episode was going to end with Nog returning to active service or not. But I mean, I know I figured the whole point on, frankly, I thought the whole point with the books was a ploy on Fontaine's part, just like the Cane, where, oh, here's something that he knows how to do. As Nog points out, he's a Ferengi. He knows how to, you know, given his father and uncle, he knows how to balance a bar's books. And, you know, it's a project that he can focus on and put his talents to and realize that, okay, I'm not totally useless. Like, I thought there was, it was possible that the end would have, you know, maybe Nog decides to work at Quark's, you know, and become the assistant manager there or something like that.
It's certainly possible. Yeah. I'm not unhappy with the way the episode ends.
No, and that's good too. It's good that Nog, at the end of the day, we just want to see Nog start to figure his shit out and turn his corner and get back to whatever his life is going to be. But at the same time, yes, Starfleet was his ambition all this time, and so it is fine that he's staying with it.
And, you know, I don't know that I want to go down a road of talking too much specifically about PTSD, because, I don't know that much about it, and I don't want to pretend that I do. But one of the things that always strikes me about this episode is, you know, well, two things. Number one is that, you know, we have talked about how Starfleet and the Federation do respect the rights of everyone. They do give them very good care.
Yeah.
This whole idea that they, you know, Nog and all Starfleet officers can choose their own rehabilitation facility. Okay, that seems fine, I guess. Ezri is checking in with them, but not really. She's not being very hands-on, I think, deliberately.
Recognizing that, I mean, it does turn out to be what does cure him or treat him at the end. And then, you know, she is recognizing that everybody treating Nog like he's a wounded veteran is what's pissing him off. You know,
right.
He doesn't want to be called a hero. He doesn't want to think about this. He needs to, in a way, distract himself completely from his pain in order to move past it. And that's what he ends up doing in this.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know that I really want to talk about whether or not holographic technology where PTSD, you know, sufferers could actually go in and live in a fantasy world for 2 weeks to get over it. I mean, that's not really realistic. But I mean, getting over it in 2 weeks is not realistic, but,
no.
You know, I don't know if that would actually be a good therapeutic tool or not, but it seems to me that at least this episode is arguing that it is, because it is allowing Nog to do things that distract him from his leg, distract him from his thoughts of the war, distract him from, you know, feeling very vulnerable, feeling very, you know, stressed out, frankly, and scared all the time. And, you know, he can't get hurt in the Holosuite. That is a good thing for him. He's able to do things, meet people, talk to people, feel productive. And, okay, it's not quote unquote real, but that's a vehicle for Nog getting better.
Yeah, it's not the end of the world if you spend your time coming home from Afghanistan by watching a bunch of movies and playing video games and using that to kind of rest for a while.
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, that's kind of the undercurrent of the entire episode, is that Nog just needs to be rested. He needs a rest from reality, and he's not going to get that on Deep Space Nine.
Some people need the extensive counseling and the sympathy and need to have people around, but that's not what Nog needs.
I mean, you could certainly see a version of this episode that, you know, wasn't interested in using standing sets to cut down costs, where he went to Ferenginar and hung out with Moogie for a month.
Yeah, exactly.
And helped her with her business or whatever she's doing now.
And I feel like that would be a little too similar to family in some ways. Yeah. But at the same time, it's, you know, whatever. Like, I like the twist they gave this. If even to, I mean, it's really, it. They've done something different with his makeup, right? He looks a lot older. I don't know if part of that is the cane, part of that is the outfits he's wearing, which remind me of, you know, stuff my grandfather, you know, wore.
I think it's some of that. Yeah.
But, you know, he is supposed to be, I mean, this does feel like a Korean War veteran who's dealing with that. I mean, especially given the time frame.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, and I guess the question I have for you, too, is, you know, do you think, because originally this episode had an A, a B, and a C story.
Oh.
And two of them were like later comedy stuff. And
this was,
and you're right. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think that you need the episode to spend this much time with them, because really this is a two character play. This is Nog and this is Vic Fontaine, and other characters pop in and out as needed. But really, this is about them. This is about their relationship. This is about Nog healing. And this is also about, because what's one of the things about this episode, I think, too, is that people forget that this is not just an episode about Nog. This is an episode about Vic Fontaine as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Why? And because that's the other side of him being, you know, such a meddler, right? Like, he is, why is he a person who is just living vicariously through other people's lives in a way? I mean, maybe that's why he, you know, why he does it, because it allows him to have some kind of influence on the real world, some kind of agency himself. And, you know, he gets very into the idea of, you know, working on the bar, you know, expanding to a new location, right, you know, meeting all of these people. You know, he enjoys all of that because it gives him some power that he can use. Both of them are, in this episode, learning the what they can do and what they're good at and how to have an impact and how to matter in the world when it's, you know, due to different situations. In Nog's case, the fact that he is mortal and he is going to die. How do I live? How do I matter when I know I'm going to die at some point and I have a concrete evidence that I can get very hurt, that it can happen to me? And for Fontaine, is dealing with the same thing. His existence is no more secure than Nog's is, really.
Yeah, his program could be deleted. I mean, certainly Vic Fontaine is not programmed to die or get older, but
no,
it is
He turns off every night.
Well, yeah, and the other thing, well, not even every night. It's really only when someone wants to run his program. But
that's
now it's
true. He mentions, you know, it's more only, you know, the most has been like 6 hours, I think he mentions.
And that's what's so interesting to me about it, too, is that, you know, the fact of the matter is Vic Fontaine is getting the right to an independent existence outside of what other people on the show want. And, you know, if it's, I mean, I'm assuming that the time of the sort of day cycle of Vic Fontaine's program and the day cycle of the station are synced, and so if it's, you know, 10 o'clock at night in Las Vegas, it's 10 o'clock at night on the station. But that's also a key indicator that they want to keep them together somehow.
Yeah,
you know, and so like Vic Fontaine, if someone wants to go, you know, if they have a couple hours in the middle of the day and they want to go to Vic Fontaine's, well, they can't because it's 2 p.m. in the afternoon and no one's performing then. So it's in a weird way, it's making, you know, the whole argument of the episode is that Nog is retreating into a fantasy world.
Yeah.
And that is not a good thing. And at the end of the episode, the non-real place has become real.
Yes. Like I said, it's probably going to be a separate part of Quark's place, you know, where it's going to be its own business on the promenade or whatever, however they're going to handle that. It's going to be it's a nightclub that's open on Deep Space Nine. It's a very non-traditional nightclub, but just as frankly we saw with Data was a non-traditional person, but he was still as much of a person. I mean, I like that that's where they're, you know, they take the theme at, you know, Vic Fontaine, as you said, has as much right to an existence as anybody else. And, you know, just because his existence is very different from everybody else's doesn't mean that the two worlds can't mesh either. I mean, they can, if people are going to go to Fontaine's and enjoy and maybe hang out with other holograms that are going to be other patrons there and watch a band that doesn't really exist, or maybe it does. I mean, they could have we've seen plenty of I mean, Odo was a piano player for real with a holographic band. It's a very interesting.
Well, he wasn't really playing the piano.
Well, but they could get somebody who really does.
Sure.
You know, that would be.
Well, and that's the other thing, too, is maybe that's how Nog convinced Quark to leave the place open all the time.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, hey, you can make a lot of money. Send people in here.
All he has to do is really show, the books to Quark and say, yeah, you know, this place is turning a profit and it doesn't even exist yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would go to Fontaine's, I think.
I would go to Fondue.
Do you think you can have fondue at Fontaine's?
I don't know. I would hope so, though.
Fondue was very popular in the 60s.
Well, there's one other thing that I want to talk about before we wrap this episode up, which is I don't think there's a lot to say about it, but I think that the ways in which really I think the episode does a good job of showing how the characters are all sort of they're not sure how to react to Nog. They're not sure how to deal with him, frankly. And I think that the early parts of the episode really, really do a good job of that. And even towards the middle of the episode, when Nog is getting a little better, he's feeling like he is in control of his life again to some degree. And here comes Jake and this woman.
Yeah.
And, you know, Nog is not happy to see them because they're intruding into his fantasy life.
And I mean, she says every single thing wrong that's, you know, he does. Now, part of it is him.
I mean, Nog is being an asshole.
Yes. But, and part of him is being paranoid. But at the same time, she is the one who's saying, oh, well, you're a hero, you know, and stuff. And, you know, again, granted, that is her trying to save herself, you know, placate him a little bit because, you know, she wasn't really doing anything. But, you know, Nog at that point needs to hit somebody and his best friend is there to be hit. And
that's that.
That's that because he needs to do that anger.
Also, I don't know why anyone has never called Nog Noggles before, but I loved it.
Aww.
All right, I think that's it for this episode. If you have any thoughts on either of the episodes of Deep Space Nine we discussed this week, please leave a comment on the post for this episode of the podcast at truckaboutshow.com. Check out our Patreon at patreon.com/truckaboutshow. If you give us $5 a month or more, you can get our patron specials that come out in the first Tuesday of every month. The one for January that came out last week is on LGBT Star Trek representation. So it's a good time for that because we've got the revelation of gay Sulu in Star Trek Beyond. We've got the first gay character coming in Star Trek Discovery, if Star Trek Discovery actually ever comes out. And you know, a couple other episodes of Star Trek through the years as well. And I'll give Richard some more context surrounding LGBT representation in Star Trek.
All right.
So look forward to that. We are on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our username is Truckabout Show. And finally, as always, please leave us an iTunes review for Truckabout. It is the best way for new fans to find the show. Next week, we're going to be talking about the episodes Prodigal Daughter and The Emperor's New Cloak.
Ooh.
And I don't usually give you any heads up about what the episodes are about, but we're recording this a few weeks ahead of time, and this is going to be the last episode that we record before I go back home for a couple weeks for Christmas. And so I just want to prepare you, Richard.
Okay.
That the last episode of Deep Space Nine that you're going to watch for two and a half weeks is the last Mirror Universe episode.
Oh my God.
I'm really sorry that the schedule worked out this way.
It's bad.
It's incredibly terrible. Oh. And it features Grand Nagusek.
Oh no, is it evil Grand Nagus too?
We'll just have to find out.